I think that for a while, a lot of topics around sustainability were being thought of in isolation, right? If you were focused on climate, you were focused on climate, or you were focused on education, you were focused on education. But we often forget the huge kind of reliance the healthcare sector has on biodiversity, as an example, and the role education plays in better, not just economic outcomes, but also health outcomes. So we're starting to see much more focus on those interdependencies and tackling them in a way where addressing one does not harm progress towards another.
Welcome to the Future in Sound podcast. I'm your host, Jen Wilson. This is a podcast where we talk about prioritizing people, planet, and profit. In each episode, we speak with world-leading experts who help us see the future we want and our role in it. This is episode 23, Connectivity. As global head of sustainable investment for Citi Global Wealth, Harlan Singh Arofsky works across Citi's investment divisions to develop and embed a comprehensive framework along the full spectrum of sustainability. Environmental, social, and governance integration, socially responsible thematic and impact investments. She ensures frameworks align with Citi's best thinking on portfolio management, research, and asset allocation. Harlan is an observing member of the Global Investment Committee at Citi and oversees the Sustainable Investing Platform. She's also a representative on Citi's Net Zero Task Force to help Citi reach its goal of net zero emissions by 2050. Prior to joining Citi in 2017, Harlan served as Associate Director of Innovative Finance at the Milken Institute, where she brought together private and public sector leaders to design and recommend investment structures to address funding gaps in the social sector. She started her career in 2002 in the foreign exchange market at Lehman Brothers. Harlan, thank you so much for joining the Future in Sound podcast.
Thank you for having me, Jennifer.
So I'm really interested, what led you to become a professional in sustainability after starting your career in banking?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a long-winded answer, to be honest. I started my career in banking in 2002. My parents' expectation was fully that I would be a lawyer or a doctor at some point in time, but neither of those things happened. But I did bring some of my upbringing into my profession. So I grew up in a culture where selfless service really underpinned our belief system. Growing up, when we were, begging our parents to let us work in the mall like every other American high schooler, my dad really insisted that we volunteer instead. It wasn't completely unusual to get that response because since I was old enough to walk, I volunteered first in our house of worship and then later through a variety of organizations ranging from soup kitchens and shelters to nursing homes and schools. So it had always been kind of a part of what I did, and it was a way of life. Finance was my profession, and the two really never met. And, I think we'll talk a little bit about that, about the trends that we're seeing in sustainable investing later. But similarly, sustainability and investing, more recently have begun to meet for many investors. And as you mentioned, yes, I did start my career at a firm called Lehman Brothers, for some of us who can remember far back enough now. And, I stayed on through the bankruptcy. And following the bankruptcy, I really started to explore just a variety of things, meditation, yoga, kind of really thinking, about things that were really outside of the day-to-day. And then it clicked, right? A few years later, I was at a different firm and they had a microfinance fund that I started to really get to know. And when it clicked, it really clicked. And I couldn't believe that, I found truly what was the perfect career for me, something that combined both my passion for service as well as my interest in skills and finance. So here we are today.
And you had a little interlude because you you were in banking, and then I saw that you spent some time being adjunct professor and teaching. And can you share a little bit more about, you know, what that period of time was like? It sounds like it was a period of time of really exploring ways of mixing different disciplines.
It definitely was. And, you know, I encourage people, you know, I do a lot of mentoring, and I've always done a lot of teaching. Earlier on in my career, I was part of a cohort that did financial literacy teaching in Harlem and the Bronx in New York City. And, you know, since then, that's always kind of been a part of me. And when I left banking in 2014, I went back to grad school. That was really the way that I switched gears from one profession to another. During that time, I actually ended up teaching a couple of courses as a TA for the undergrad program. And when I went to the Milken Institute, it was really all about deepening my skill set, my knowledge, my understanding of sustainability. They are an economic think tank and focus on all areas of sustainability, identifying where there might be market failures, and then investment solutions that could meet those. So it was a really great experience and way for me to bridge the gap. And now here I am back in banking at Citi, and it's offered me, you know, the skill set and the background to really navigate both traditional finance and sustainability.
And so you've been back at Citi since 2017. I'm wondering, as you look at some of the core macro themes, what are some of the things that you're seeing in responsible investment right now?
Oh my gosh, so much, right? So we'll stay away from the news for a second here, but I guess there are really two answers I would go with here. One around the macro themes as it relates to the economic and geopolitical environment. Of course, both have created some challenges and increased uncertainty in the timing of the energy transition. The move in rates has also significantly impacted businesses who have higher upfront CapEx requirements and are very sensitive to financing their growth. We also saw this in the food and ag sector, right, over the last couple of years, particularly with disruptions in the supply chains, higher energy costs impacting fertilizer production and distribution, and more obviously, I guess, the physical impacts of climate that are becoming more frequent in nature, exacerbating these disruptions. And then the second, I would say, is an increased focus on a just transition and overall affordability and accessibility of innovation. That's, you know, expected to address some of these challenges. I think that for a while, a lot of topics around sustainability were being thought of in isolation, right? If you were focused on climate, you were focused on climate, or you were focused on education, you were focused on education. And I think over the last couple of years, what we're starting to see, especially the last year and a half or so, that affordability and accessibility, of course, are going to play a huge role to have an orderly transition. And then the other components, right? So it's not just energy and climate, but they're also reliant and interdependent on areas like healthcare and education. We often forget the huge kind of reliance the healthcare sector has on biodiversity, as an example, and the role education plays in better, not just economic outcomes, but also health outcomes. So there's a whole bunch of connectivity between these sustainability outcomes, and, you know, hence why the UN published them as 17 SDGs. And we're starting to see much more focus on those interdependencies and tackling them in a way where addressing one does not harm progress towards another.
I'd love to, you know, dig into interconnectivity to a greater extent, actually, because classic sustainability thinking has all been about systems. Mm-hmm. And what you're articulating is sort of systems thinking when it comes to sustainability. And so I'd love to hear a little bit more later in the interview on, you know, practically, okay, how can we apply our minds to that as practitioners? But before we get there, there's been some back and forth on the term ESG. Obviously, it is, you know, by its very nature, environmental, social governance is somewhat siloed. You know, are we going to be using this term in 5 years, do you think?
Yeah, it's such a funny question because I think it's top of mind. Almost every ESG or sustainability related conference I attend, the question comes up, right? I do get it asked a lot from my own colleagues as well. You know, I actually hope that we will continue to use it, but I actually hope that we continue to use it in the right way, meaning we use it to describe data, right? It's environmental, social, and governance data. That data can be used to inform decisions in multitudes of ways, whether that's exclusions or inclusions or themes or measuring impact, right? It is, you know, I think we've started to use it too much as a catch-all, right? It's become kind of that proverbial kitchen sink. And so it's frustrating for people on all sides of the aisle. And I would say rightfully, I think that we will probably still be using it, but I hope that we will be using it in the right way.
Got it. And so when you think, just getting a little bit, you know, deeper into your approach, I'm interested in, you know, what does exceptional integration of sustainability into investment decisions look like?
Now, that's something I hope does go away in 5 years. And the reason I say that is that, you know, right now, the integration of ESG data is optional for most managers, right? Almost every portfolio manager I know would argue that governance has always been a part of the investment decision making. But if we only look at governance through the ENS lens, even that can be optional. And so for strategies to qualify as ESG integration for us, we need them to demonstrate that this data is a binding part of the investment process. It's not optional. You know, when we look at some of the strategies that are kind of stronger as it relates to ESG integration, they're not just looking at it as a way to mitigate risk, right? So thinking about how climate risk or transition risk may impact a company's performance, but also as a way to identify opportunities to generate alpha. And, you know, when we think about that and how that plays out in public markets, those who are doing it really well are also using the power of shareholder engagement to align their strategies with their sustainability goals. And when you talk to those managers, they're also thinking about it in the terms of those goals are also in alignment with financial goals. And so as we think about ESG integration and why I kind of said, you know, I hope that that does go away in 5 years, ultimately, the data is becoming better. It's becoming more available. And increasingly, what we're seeing is that portfolio managers are starting to take these data points more seriously in their investment decision making. And so it'll become even harder to, you know, it won't become optional. It won't be so optional for most managers. It'll become a part of the investment process, just like earnings growth is part of the investment process.
I'd really love to get into, you know, what we mean by, you know, optional in this instance. Could we go through an example of, you know, where it feels optional versus really truly integrated? You don't have to name a particular company, but if you take us through a fictitious investment decision and, you know, where it's truly integrated versus not, that would, I think, help the audience.
Yeah, certainly. So climate risk, for example, right? One of the more quantifiable risks as it relates to sustainability. There are tons of different models that are trying to predict what climate risk could look like to the price of an asset. And increasingly for investment managers, they are considering climate risk in their investment decision making. However, the degree of potential risk to that asset is not what's driving their investment decision in that asset. And so it's a small nuance, which eventually, if the risk is too high from a climate perspective, any asset manager won't want to invest in that specific asset, right? It's just right now the data is, you know, these are long-term models. It's hard to say what exactly that material risk will be to the price performance of an asset. So it is a little bit more on the optional side. For strategies that we consider truly ESG integrated, those asset managers are making decisions based on this data, whether it be climate risk, as this example states, or it's around broader sustainability risks or sustainability attributes. So really investing in companies that are leaders within their sectors or are gaining momentum as it relates to ESG, and that's all substantiated by the data, right? So it's 100% part of their investment process.
How does this approach, in your experience, differ between public and private markets?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Actually, and you know what's interesting is that I think private markets are starting to really gain a lot more attention from investors just because it's a bit more tangible. And in private markets, what we've seen is that the focus is really around themes, right? Sustainability themes and investing in companies that are creating the innovation and solutions to apply technology, right? So whether it's education technology, fintech, climate tech, ag tech, name the tech, right? Technology is playing a huge role in these thematic areas. And there are companies that are creating incredible innovation as it relates to addressing some of these issues. And the thematic areas that, you know, they are quite broad, and some of the investment opportunities are incredibly interesting. So, you know, tying it back to the question around ESG integration, right? So in private markets, we're much more focused on the thematic alignment from revenue that a company is generating. But the dialogue is getting a bit more kind of nuanced around the impact and the reporting of impact and how frequently an asset manager is expected to report on that impact. So that's a difference, I think, between public and private markets. And in public markets, you're not really seeing that requirement for impact reporting as much as you are in private markets. And the other day, you know, even that part of it, the impact reporting, is getting more nuanced. The other day I was speaking with somebody and they were asking questions around impact reporting and what the expectation is, and why is it that companies are allowed to kind of decide which metrics to report on? So meaning the reporting is coming top down versus the people who are being impacted by whatever that intervention is or whatever that product or service is, being able to report up what the impact was on their lives. So like take, for example, a company providing education services. They'll report on the number of people who have used their service as their measure of impact. But is that truly the number of people who are impacted in terms of how their livelihoods changed as a result of using that service? So it's a nuance. And I think that, you know, impact reporting itself will continue to evolve over time. Of course, in private markets, right, a lot of these companies are smaller. They're still in a growth stage, and the more kind of onerous impact reporting gets, the more costly it is. And so there's still some work to do there in terms of making this type of reporting easier in a way, easier both to report and to compare between different strategies.
That makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that I'm thinking, just as you're talking about, not just counting the number of people that, you know, from a top-down perspective, an organization feels have been impacted, but asking them, you know, the impacted individuals, you know, what their experience was. We talk a lot about customer net promoter score, even employee net promoter score for a company, and some sort of, you know, way of scoring the impact from stakeholders. It's almost like a stakeholder NPS. Maybe, Harlan, you and I just came up with something on this interview.
Totally. It's great in theory. It's great in theory. It might be a little bit more complicated in practice.
I think so too. Maybe we need to workshop it a little bit more. The other thing that I'd love to bring in here, maybe when we're talking about private markets, you started the interview, you know, sharing some views that I found really powerful on connectivity. Mm-hmm. What are some examples of ways that we can apply connectivity between different sustainability factors in private equity and sustainability? Like, are there any best practices that you've observed that you could share with the audience?
One area that I've really been exploring with clients is around likening impact to asset allocation, where we're used to thinking about a diversified asset allocation to be the prudent way to invest and to protect our assets and grow our assets over time. If we apply that concept to impact and really start to think about impact allocation, I think, A, we can really mobilize more capital towards addressing these challenges, and B, do it in a much more thoughtful way. You know, I'll give you an example here. So, you know, I've worked with a client for many years now, whose main kind of focus, or North Star, call it, is around gender diversity and improving outcomes specifically for girls in emerging markets. Now, emerging markets opportunities, particularly for services and companies that are developing products for girls, are going to be limited. But then you start to think about the ecosystem of impact, or the ecosystem that needs to shift in order to provide opportunities for women and girls in all markets and in emerging markets. And you can start to invest or deploy capital towards areas like clean water and sanitation, healthcare, education, and really build out an allocation of impact, right? That overarching impact kind of theory of change will align with this North Star of progress for women and girls, but through a more diversified approach, right? Rather than just investing in, call it, gender lens strategies.
That's a really excellent example. Thank you. I'm wondering, in terms of how Citi looks at ESG and value creation, you know, what are some of the ways, because obviously, you know, we're going through a period of time where many of us are tightening our belts. There's a real focus on, you know, getting through slower growth in the economy. And I'm just wondering, how does Citi connect ESG to value creation?
I've heard, you know, Jane talk about this, Jane Fraser, our CEO, and Val Smith, our Chief Sustainability Officer. And it's the same as you would think about it as an investor. Improving efficiency, having strong governance, having strong labor practices are all good for a business. And so it's not something that is seen as a cost center any longer. It is something that improves resiliency of a business, improves competitiveness of a business. You know, we are in financial markets. It is an industry, a sector that is important to sustainable progress. We play a really strong role in that. It's not I think that it's not so much a discussion around value creation anymore or a debate around it. It's more of a kind of known.
That's really refreshing to hear, you know, that sometimes it's hard to say exactly how much, you know, governance is driving value, but it's sort of obvious that it is driving value. And similarly, you know, just seeing environmental risks and social risks and opportunities as basically strategic and business risk and opportunities really changes the conversation. So thank you for that. Many individuals listening to this are going to be really curious. You know, Harlan, you speak eloquently on topics related to sustainability and present on a regular basis. I'm wondering, what do you read to stay up to speed on ESG?
I read a lot of research, actually. I do read a lot of research that's published by Citi, our Citi research team, as well as some of our peers in financial services. It's such a fast-moving space that I find it easier to stay up to date by reading kind of current research that's coming out. But I really do love podcasts, and I'm not just saying that because I'm talking to you here, but there are so many great ones out there that are focused on ESG and sustainability that, you know, you're really kind of getting real-time feedback on events, on legislation, on climate catastrophes that are going on around the world. So you're really kind of getting a lot of that up-to-date information. The podcasts that I find also that are really interesting are the ones that are traditionally more finance or investments focused that now are starting to add content around sustainability. So, you know, think about the big financial news services that have their podcasts. And now every now and again, we hear something about climate risk or hydrogen or nuclear. And I think it's really important to those of us who are in this quote unquote bubble and who live and breathe sustainability every single day to engage with more traditional investors as well.
Are you able to share a particular podcast that you listen to? Or if there's, you know, one or two that you particularly enjoy?
Well, I do love Odd Lots. They don't talk about sustainability that often, but just yesterday or the day before, they were talking about nuclear. I listen to the FT News briefing every single day, but there are a bunch on sustainability as well that are out there that are, I think, really good. I think, you know, Ian Bremmer's G0 podcast is also really good, bringing together the geopolitical side as well as sustainability. But there are quite a few. I think Bloomberg has a couple that are sustainability focused as well that are really interesting.
Thank you. I'll have to, a couple of those I listen to, but I'll have to add a couple of those to my queue. Thanks for repping a podcast, Harlan. I appreciate it. And my final question for you is, if there's one book that's most influenced your thinking on responsible investment, which would it be?
Yeah. So there's a book that I read, I want to say in like 2012 or so, Paul Polak's book, Out of Poverty. And it really, to me, felt very much of a turning point in terms of how innovation and entrepreneurship can really change the livelihoods of people and where business and progress really connect. And so that was a book that really influenced me early on.
Harlan, I've so enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us on the Future in Sound.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Harlan for joining us. You can learn more about her work by checking out the links in the episode description or by visiting re.co.com/The Future in Sound. The Future in Sound podcast is written and hosted by Jen Wilson and produced by Chris Attaway. This podcast is brought to you by Rico, a software as a services company helping clients achieve resilient, competitive advantage in the long term. If you enjoyed this podcast, I'd so appreciate you recommending it to a friend or liking it in your podcast app. Until next time, thanks for listening.